supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a jam-packed show for you today, cats and kittens. Coming up later, we will interview a woman who goes by the handle of Moss and Annie, who wants to bring more moss into your life. We'll also tell you a great thing you can do for your garden if you need to take a week off. Well, that's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kristen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Kristen. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Oh, I'm better than okay. Let's see if we can make Kristen better than okay. Where is Kristen only feeling okay?
I'm in Westchester,
Pennsylvania
here.
Just outside of Philly.
Yes.
All right. What can we do for you?
Well, I've had this apple tree. It'll be the 13th year, and about 2 years ago in the ice storm, two huge choke cherries that had been shading the apple tree came down, mm-hmm. and we've had them removed, and this spring was the first year that it was covered in apple blossoms, and we had apples. The problem, the apples were beautiful if you scrub them down. They had this film, like a black tar-like almost film over them.
Mm-hmm.
And once we scrubbed them down, it was a lovely variety, and I used them for so many different things, and they were so tasty. But my question is, was this a fungus? I have a friend that worked at the Longwood Gardens, and she suggested that, oh, it might be some type of fungus. So,
do you know, I mean, if you could read my email, people think that when their car headlight doesn't work, it's a fungus. I mean, it's like a rigged wheel at a carnival. No matter how many times you spin it, it comes up fungus. Some people, mm-hmm. that's all they can think of. How tall is the tree?
10.
Okay, so it's a nice...
Wait a minute.
10 or 25? So it's a standard tree. It's not a dwarf tree or anything like that.
Yeah.
I would urge you to wait until the apple tree blooms again. That's when you can really see which branches are dead and which are not and which are really healthy. You would have the tree pruned back. You would have it opened up for better airflow. And then... when the blossoms form the apples, the, quote, low-hanging fruit, the stuff that you could get to easily, like either by hand or on a stepladder,
mm-hmm.
I want you to thin the fruits. Somehow you got incredibly lucky. Pull off enough apples so that in between everything that's left, there would be room for a full-size apple. Now, there are a million things that can go wrong with apple trees, especially when they haven't been pruned in ages. But there's a million things it could be. My first guess is it sounds like that could be aphid poop. Aphids colonize roses, fruit trees, things like that, and they suck sap. A lot of times they don't harm the plant, but they poop like crazy. And their frass, which is a $20 word for bug poop, mm-hmm. is called honeydew because it's sweet and it attracts ants, but it also blackens the surface it falls on. But the black doesn't go through. It washes off.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think if you had any kind of a real disease or a real pest problem, you would have found worms in your apples or the apples would have turned black or, you know, there would have been obvious signs of disease that would have run down into the flesh. You simply by pruning the tree and by thinning the fruits a little bit more than you did this year, or just at least continuing that, I think that will limit the damage. If you want to have some fun, and if you think it's going to happen again and you're worried about it, you can mail order a quart or a gallon of ladybugs. And what you would do is on an evening, right after they arrived, You would go out, and this is the only time you would ever do this. You would hose the tree down with water. And right after the sunset, you would release the ladybugs all around the tree. They won't fly away at night. They'll fly up into the branches to get the water. And then if you're lucky, they'll breed and their children will consume all the aphids.
Okay.
If not, how terrible is it to have ladybugs flying around?
Oh, of course not.
Yeah. All right, Kristen, you got so lucky already. You are already at the top of the apple game.
Thank you.
All right, you take care.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Bernard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Okay.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine. I'm trucking right along.
And where is Bernard trucking?
In Medford, New Jersey.
All right. Right across the bridge from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
All right. So what can we do for Bernard in Medford, New Jersey?
I've got an old tree. I only know it as a smoke tree. About 4 feet around and about 35 feet wide and 35 feet high. And the thing has long pods on it, beans, millions of them. But I have a problem with caterpillar-type worms. They strip the tree every season. I've tried spraying it. It cost me $200 at a time to do it. I sprayed it myself. It works in the beginning of the year, but come around August or so, caterpillars invade the tree and they strip it bare. What else can I do?
Well, clearly you're not harming the caterpillars, but it sounds like you've been using some really intensive chemicals. And I will tell you that, unfortunately, and you didn't know this, but when you used the systemic insecticide,
yeah.
You killed any bees or butterflies or anything else that came to that tree when it flowered. Now, is this tree mulched?
No.
Is
it's in a grass lawn.
It's in a grass lawn. Has it been fed?
No.
Good. And is the lawn treated with chemical herbicides like weed and
no.
feed? And what time of year do the caterpillars show up?
They show up in the late spring. And lasts all summer.
And yet the tree leafs out successfully every season.
It has so far. I've been with it for 35 years now, and it comes back each time, even though it's a bare stick when they're finished with it.
Well, there are trees and caterpillars that have this bizarre symbiotic relationship. In a few rare cases, the tree is actually dependent on the caterpillars, because, you know, when they feed on the leaves, they poop like mad.
Tell me about it.
Well, that actually feeds the tree. So there's a couple of things you can do to break this cycle, however. One is you should really get out there and get the grass away from the base of the tree. Not with any kind of herbicides. Just get a good, high-quality hoe. And just try to hoe away the grass until you've got a good foot circle of bare earth all around the tree. And if you can't see the root flare of the tree where it enters the ground, if the tree looks like a big lollipop, scrape away some of the dirt until you can see some evidence of the roots. And then, if you're up for it, I mean, I would very much suggest you get a couple of bags of high-quality compost. Not composted manure. Just yard waste compost made with fall leaves. And mulch the tree with that. Not touching the trunk, but going out a foot or two. That'll feed the tree naturally. It'll also help keep that grass at bay. But there is an organic solution to caterpillars that will stop this infestation as soon as it starts.
Okay.
The scientific name is Bacillus thuringiensis. It's commonly called BT. And the most common brand name is Dipel, D-I-P-E-L.
Okay.
It comes under a bunch of different brand names, and Dipel is the most common and well-known, so just look to see that the active ingredient is BT, is Bacillus thuringiensis. then as soon as you see the first caterpillar, you mix up the BT as instructed, and you spray as much of the tree as you can reach. If the tree is really tall and there's a canopy up there, don't be afraid to use a pressure washer up top if you have to. Every caterpillar that eats any leaf that got sprayed with the BT, their stomach will stop working and they will die. It's much more effective than chemical insecticides, and it doesn't pose any threats to bees or other creatures or you.
All right, BT then. And I had to spray that, what, a couple, three, four times a year?
If you are out there and you see when the first caterpillars appear and you really saturate the tree, you may only have to do it once.
All right, sounds good.
All right, man?
Okay, thank you.
All right, good luck, Bryn.
All right, bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear next Saturday, April 2nd, at the Del Val Home Show at the Ice Works in Aston, PA, and at the Lancaster, Pennsylvania Master Gardener Symposium on Saturday, April 9th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with cool moss, empty beds, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. What can you possibly do with a garden when you know in advance you're not going to be able to take care of it for a year? How do you prevent it from becoming a weedy mess? Well, how about making it a better garden during that year? We'll tell you how when we get to the question of the week. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it is time to welcome our special guest, Mossing Annie, who was interviewed by our own producer of You Bet Your Garden, Alexis Landis.
We're happy to have Annie Martin, also known as Mossin' Annie, in the studio today to talk about her new book, published through Timber Press, The Magical World of Moss Gardening. Annie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're so happy to have you here. So I love the name Mawson Annie. When we first started talking, I just thought that was so great. And tell us a little bit about why you call yourself Mawson Annie. I know you sort of go around with your truck and you rescue moss. Is that right?
Well, that's one aspect of being a mosser. And a mosser is a person who actively engages in rescuing or harvesting mosses, who grows mosses, who gardens with mosses, who just plain old loves mosses.
Well, I wanted to start with you reading a sample from your book that I thought really elicited the feeling of moss. Could you do that for us?
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. Y'all, this really comes from the heart. Mosses offer visual delights and tactile pleasures. They stoke our imagination and our memories. They connect us to earlier peoples and moss gardeners around the globe. They have countless environmental advantages and medicinal uses, and they are simply a joy to garden with.
Thank you. I love the way that makes you feel. And, you know, I notice in my landscape when I pad across the soft moss, it sort of elicits this wonderful feeling of a summer evening or something. It really triggers that memory, and I think that's so interesting that you think that too.
Many people have moss memories. The purpose of any garden, in my opinion, is to make your heart smile and to lift your spirits. Sometimes it can be a place where you process your emotions of sadness or grief, but it can also be a time to celebrate, to dance like a fairy under the full moon. So the pleasures of mosses are visual, they're spiritual, they're experiential, and as you mentioned, walking on them or even touching them with your hands, the tactile experience is magical as well.
A lot of people have, you know, kind of an obsession with having the perfect green grass yard here in America. And we get a lot of calls to You Bet Your Garden about how do we, you know, make our grass thicker in a shaded or wet area. And oftentimes Mike says, you know what, you may have to move over to moss, because grass isn't going to grow in that kind of condition. So talk a little bit about that. Why is it a great option to have a moss lawn?
First of all, I would suggest that you target your initial efforts into moss gardening in a shady location. And although most people think that all mosses live in the shade, that's not necessarily the case. There are some that are sun species. So you could expand out from beyond that oak tree perimeter where nothing else will ever grow into other areas of the yard as focal features or as an expansive lawn. But it's a big task. And there are some special methods that are needed to establish a moss lawn or a moss garden. And basically, I'm just going to call them the three W's right now. Once you've prepared your location, and we may go into this, but you want to water them, walk on your mosses, and unfortunately, you will have to weed them. That's the last W.
So the middle W, walking on them, is not something people are used to doing with their other plants.
I know, and can you imagine? I sit on them as soon as I plant them. So, but walking on your mosses is an essential step in successful moss gardening because it helps the rhizoids to attach to a substrate. And if you move on into some other advantages for the environment, you'll discover that you can avoid the use of chemicals for other challenges that most gardeners face as well.
I love seeing the different types of mosses in the book, and you say that there's a tonal range, and you note that that could be from sun exposure or moisture. Could you talk about that a little bit?
I sure could. Moss green is a term that you hear applied oftentimes to fabrics or paint colors. And I'm always wondering, well, exactly which color green do they mean? Because the range can be from a deep emerald green to almost like a golden greenish glow peridot. They have jewel tones. And the leaves that I mentioned that don't have cuticle, they're also only one cell layer thick, so they're translucent, and they transmit light differently. There are species that just within that particular type, like Climacium americanum, which happens to be my favorite moss for many reasons, but it starts off as a little deep green, almost Christmas tree. And as it grows to maturity over the phases, it will go into a medium green shade. Then it goes kind of olive. And then I will admit, it does turn kind of brown and dead. But the beauty of Climacium is that if you leave that ugly part on, it sprouts new parts from every part of the plant, which is one of the features of mosses. They can grow from fragments, and certain species are better at achieving those results. And that is something that those people that want to have a moss lawn might want to consider. How do you plant a moss feature and cover larger spaces?
Right. So do you start with a small little piece of moss and that moss will sort of spread out? How do you approach it?
Well, I create moss magic and it's instantaneous. So when I come to an installation, I roll out the green carpet at my mossery in North Carolina. I have cultivated mosses on 6 feet by 6 feet sections. But the upright growers, you can place contiguously, which means right next to each other. For the sideways growers, I interleaf the edges over, under, over, under, and that will give you a solid landscape of mosses. Now, you need to have a lot of resources to do that, either opportunities to relocate mosses from other parts of your property to focal areas up closer to the house where you can enjoy them, or you may be involved in a rescue. You may decide that you want to purchase mosses.
Tell us about your rescues that you just mentioned. You rescue some from driveways, right?
Yeah, I rescue them from anywhere I can get the mosses because I always have my I Spy moss radar on. And there are many opportunities. Now, when you talk about moss harvesting, oftentimes you're thinking people associate it with stealing. I'm talking about rescues where they're going to be destroyed anyhow, or perhaps where they're underappreciated. I'll be happy to take it away. It could be off of a roof because mosses frequently will grow on asphalt shingles, sometimes on wooden shingles. And people have been convinced by the roofing industry and the insurance companies that it's a bad thing for mosses to grow. Well, I intentionally planted mosses on my roof just to prove that it would be fine and dandy, and they're doing great. I will say on a wood roof, cedar shakes, for instance, eventually I do believe the mosses would break down the wood and could cause some deterioration. Asphalt shingles, though, it's just a waste of your money to remove shingles just because of mosses.
No matter where a home gardener might be placing their moss, you say they should really think about it and plan first, right?
The one gardener's adage that you should follow is right place, right plant. And in this case, right micro niche, right moss, so that you are choosing the appropriate species. For instance, on a sunny hillside, I would choose to use Polytrichum, because it has rhizoids that go deeper into the soil that almost mimic roots. You can have success with other species in shady areas, which I might recommend Thuinium. Now, I mentioned my favorite Climacium, and it is ideal for stormwater mitigation or those soggy areas that you're never going to be able to divert that pooling occurring. And so it just, you wouldn't believe how lush that area will become. These troublesome areas of your garden can become the focal features when you utilize mosses. So it's really a win-win for all concerned, for the gardener and for the environment.
Now, Annie, I know you're from North Carolina, so we have a lot of listeners from the southern states. Is there a difference between how mosses grow in the north versus the south in a warmer climate?
Well, mosses are going to thrive anywhere in the country. The key is the supplemental watering. And most people, as gardeners, are used to providing drenching soaks. Mosses only have that one cell layer thick leaf, and they hydrate very quickly. So we're talking watering sessions that last a whopping 2 to 3 minutes. There's another water conservation. You just don't have to water them very long. And that's a big advantage.
Well, your enthusiasm, Annie, has been absolutely infectious. We've loved having you. We've been speaking with Annie Martin, author of The Magical World of Moss Gardening. You can find out more at mountainmoss.com, where you can get an autographed copy of her book. So there's lots to see there. But, you know, Annie, we've loved having you. It's been a wonderful journey through the world of moss, and we really appreciate having you on the show.
Thank you so much, Alexis, and Mike, too. It's a pleasure because I would bet my garden on mosses every time and come out to be a winner.
1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Hello.
Hello. How are you, Carol?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm calling from Califon in Hunterdon County, New Jersey.
Okay.
And I have a mosquito question on the follow-up of Dr. Dina Fonseca's wonderful program that you had last week.
Wasn't that a great show?
That was fabulous, and thank you for letting her have the entire hour. I learned so much.
I learned so much. I thought I was like the mosquito prevention expert, and I'm sitting over there taking notes.
Yeah, it was very good. My question to her was, who actually eats adult mosquitoes? We've all heard for years that bats eat mosquitoes. I highly doubt that, because when you look at a mosquito and a bat, they're not going to get that many calories for the effort. And even in checking out dragonfly information this week, a lot of the references don't say that dragonflies eat mosquitoes. In fact, they say they prefer larger prey. But some of the general references sort of toss in, and they eat mosquitoes. And I'm just wondering, does anybody really know?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And I may know this better than Dr. Fonseca, because I have researched this heavily going all the way back to my days at Organic Gardening magazine. And number one, you are entirely correct. And it breaks the heart of people who spent time and energy putting up bat houses to find out that bats really don't eat many, if any, mosquitoes, for very much the reason you mentioned. Bats are not out that long. They have very high metabolic rates. They need to eat big prey, like night-flying moths. The line about bats eating mosquitoes came from a researcher who isolated bats and mosquitoes in a test cage to see how many they could eat.
Okay. But
neither creature could get out of the cage. So, I mean, and
what are you going to do?
Exactly. So, there, you know, it was an interesting experiment, but it does not happen in real life. Now, the biggest consumers of mosquitoes outdoors are dragonflies and birds. But in the United States, and specifically in the region that we share here in the Mid-Atlantic, it is birds like swifts, like swallows. Swallows are probably the biggest mosquito eaters. And as you know, swallows love to nest near mosquito-infested areas. If there's an old barn near a pond, it's filled with swallow nests. But the common name, one of the common names for certain types of dragonflies, is mosquito hawk. We did an article years ago. So if you go to our website, you go to youbetyourgarden.org and click on Garden Answers A to Z at the top, and either go to M for mosquitoes or D for dragonflies. We did this great article about which dragonflies are the best mosquito eaters and about different ways to attract them to your home. There are some great cool tips out there in the research to bring more dragonflies to your property. But these are low-tech things that you'd be doing for the dragonflies, like just making little perches for them to sit in your garden, designing them in a very attractive way so that the day-flying mosquitoes, the ones that come out in the evening, the dragonflies are very comfortable being around you to go after them. But that is the majority of their prey. And as you say, mosquitoes are small, but dragonflies have become very effective at capturing large numbers of them, that they can really make a difference.
Okay.
All right. How's that?
That answered my question. Thanks again. Enjoy the show very much.
All right. Thank you, Carol. Good luck.
Bye-bye, Mike.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear in the Oklahoma City area twice on Earth Day Eve, Thursday, April 21st. I'll give a talk on composting on the University of Central Oklahoma campus at 3 p.m. Thursday afternoon, and then promote pollinators in a KGOU-sponsored evening event at the fabulous Myriad Garden. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with how to make an empty bed productive and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a few minutes, we will do the seemingly impossible. We will tell you how to leave a garden bed empty for a week and yet make it more productive. How are we going to do that? You're going to find out after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1 888-346-9499. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm fine.
And where is Bill fine?
I'm in central Pennsylvania in Penns Creek. I'm near Mifflinburg, PA.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Bill in central PA?
Well, I use shredded leaves extensively for my mulch, and the small towns around here collect and shred them in the fall, and they're glad to give them away. And I mulch my asparagus beds with shredded leaves, but I'm being invaded by a weed called Creeping Charlie, and it seems to love the mulch, and it just goes right under it. And last year, I had a carpet of Creeping Charlie on my asparagus beds, and I tried pulling it out, but you just can't keep up with this stuff. So this year I went out and bought a 500,000 BTU weed burner. And a couple days ago, I torched the beds and I burned up all of Creeping Charlie. It looked nice and green already. But I'm wondering whether I also cooked the asparagus. What do you think?
Even if you damaged the first run of spears, even if you did a little bit of damage to the tips of the earliest spears, as you know, new spears keep popping up. Now, I'm like totally bemused by this. Did you set your leaf mulch on fire?
Well, yeah, the leaves that were on top of the ground burned right with the Creeping Charlie, and I cleaned most of the asparagus rubble away last fall, but my second question is, I have a problem with asparagus beetles, and I'm wondering if heat flame treating, you know, heat treating the bed might burn up the eggs of those miserable pests, as well as taking care of the Creeping Charlie.
Well, you know, you're going to call us back in a couple of months and tell us. Because that's a strong possibility. It is absolutely a really good possibility that you could have taken care of two problems at once. Now, Creeping Charlie, I hesitate to ask this, but where is it coming from? Creeping Charlie is a ground cover that was originally deliberately planted because you see it has beautiful purple color and has a wonderful smell when you crush it. It smells like sage. But is it coming out of a lawn?
Yeah, it is. I planted my asparagus on the inside of my garden fence around the perimeter of the garden. So there is a lawn on the outside of the fence.
And how do you?
I burned it up, too.
How do you keep the grass out of the asparagus bed?
Well, I put down cardboard mulch, and then I put shredded leaf mulch on top.
What I'm going to suggest is you invest in some good, strong garden edging, you know, that you drive into the ground and you make a firm perimeter around the outside of your bed. Now, you and I know that some spears are eventually going to come up outside this perimeter, but this is a wall that we want to do to keep the grass and the Creeping Charlie on the other side. Make sure it has a lip of a couple of inches, and then you'll see the Charlie as it tries to start getting up. And then if it's outside the asparagus bed, you can go to our website. There's a solution you can make with 20 Mule Team Borax that makes a very effective herbicide for Creeping Charlie in the summertime. But as you know, it's also very easy to pull out of wet soil.
Well, I'll give that a try.
And if you still have trouble with asparagus beetles, put up some suet feeders around the outside of the asparagus bed to bring in birds to do some of the work for you.
Okay, we do put up suet, but it also attracts bears.
Oh, well, no, cancel that. Keep flame weeding, Bill. Keep Yogi away.
Okay, well, thank you, Mike.
All right, good luck, Bill.
We'll give it a try, and I'll let you know how it turns out.
Yeah, please do give us a call back about those beetles. I'm curious now.
Okay, very good.
Take care.
Again, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Yep, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, and yourself? Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Steve. Where are you, sir?
I am in East Hampton, New Jersey.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Steve in the Garden State?
Well, I'm actually currently a senior in the environmental science program at Stockton University. And for one of my classes, we're doing a project that we're implementing a permaculture garden on campus.
Okay.
Really, my question was trying to figure out what plants, A, grow best in, you know, southern New Jersey, and which ones, I guess, are the most resilient or the easiest to keep alive.
And we're talking edibles.
Yes, yes, definitely edible plants.
Well, you just said you're a senior man, right?
Yes.
So you're going with the wind in a couple of months.
The school is okay with us doing it?
Well, I mean, I think your biggest issue, 90% of this, is somehow to establish a chain of succession.
Okay.
Because it doesn't matter how well it, quote, takes care of itself. Is there a group or an organization or a fraternity, a sorority, a school of sciences that includes plants that would promise to at least check on this thing and know it's there and, you know, harvest it?
Well, I know there's a group of student workers who currently work in our greenhouse on campus.
Right, so you have a greenhouse. Who? What's that under the auspices of?
That's under the NAMS, basically Natural Arts, Sciences, and Mathematics kind of umbrella.
And there's a professor who runs the greenhouse?
Yes.
Okay, so that's your person. Have you?
Yeah, we've already been in contact. They're actually the ones who are okaying our project. Yeah.
Okay, good. So they will continue it.
Yes, and I think with the help of some of the student workers, it's got a chain of succession in the works as of now, yeah.
Okay. And you're talking permaculture, right? You're talking perennial vegetables.
Ideally, we would like something that can come back. I mean, we have like a kind of preliminary list now of plants that are recognizable by lots of people. You know, your grapes, your raspberries, blackberries. It's obviously stuff that's enticing to eat, not something that, you know, something that you can go and pick on the fly on your way to class or whatever.
Okay. So raspberries are an excellent choice. If they are planted in poor soil, protected from chemicals, and allowed to roam vast distances, that's the perfect plant for your situation because they are perennial. The only thing that will need to be done to raspberries is to prune out the dead canes, the canes that are so dead they're brittle and that snap off.
Yeah.
And that's not even a hard thing to do. Grapevines are actually high maintenance.
Okay.
You know, they would need to be pruned. They would need to be thinned. They are attacked by many things. They are great plants if you have somebody there paying attention. But raspberries don't care if there's anyone there paying attention. They're going to do their thing. So that's probably the ultimate perfect plant. Next in line, I would say, would be blueberries.
Yeah, it's another one that we had on our list.
But the soil needs to be made extremely acidic. And it's in permaculture, it's not that difficult to make long-term mulches to prevent weeds. But the plants would need to be protected from birds or the students would not get any.
Okay.
So if you have the room, these are almost ideally high bush blueberries or plants that you would grow inside a big cage that students could open the door and go in, but the mesh would be too small for birds to go in. Blackberries are just as easy as raspberries. Blackberries, except for a couple of varieties, tend to have really vicious thorns. Raspberries also can be pretty thorny. So you, kids are going to get scratched up. I don't know, whether you want to put up warning signs, watch it. You know, canes are thorny, but the berries are delicious.
Okay.
Raspberries are really the indestructible one here. All right. The responsibility succession. Yes, I agree. Next year, I will take care of the basic needs of these plants. That's all you need. And like I said, the raspberries, they really don't even need that. You know, if the college was abandoned 100 years from now, people could walk onto the grounds and pick millions of raspberries.
Well, that's a good thing, yeah.
All right, man. Good luck.
All righty. Thank you very much. I'll hopefully everything goes well, and we'll let you know how it works out.
Yes, please do. All right. Take care, and congratulations on graduating.
Oh, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. What you can do when your garden takes a year off. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's very intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. Jaina in Matawan, New Jersey writes, "For various and sundry reasons, there is a strong possibility I may have to take a break from my garden this year. I won't be able to plant, weed, water, etc. Is there something I can do that would help the garden benefit from this time off? I have 6 raised beds that are each 4 feet by 12 feet. In the winter, they are each covered with black plastic to keep out weed seeds until spring. And at the beginning of the season, when the plastic is pulled off, they are perfect. Just bare soil and compost. It would be nice when I do go back to gardening to have done something good for the soil while I was gone. And it would also be nice not to have it all turn into a field of weeds. I love your show, and thank you so much for your help." Mike, this is a great question, and it's one that we get frequently, but that you...
Always try to ignore? Yeah, you got that right. But this time, I just happen to have a thought that seems to fit her situation to a T. But first, I have to say that we also ran her query on our Facebook page a week or so ago and got some shockingly poor answers.
Right, right, right. That guy who says to, quote, "just plant wildflowers and let nature take its course."
Yeah. I mean, come on. The right mix would attract a lot of pollinators, but even wildflowers require care, and there's a good chance an otherwise unattended garden would have serious weed issues the following season. Maybe spread some wildflower seed in nearby uncultivated areas, but let's make use of the fact that she has what sound like really well-designed raised beds to solarize that soil.
Right. So many people call in with really serious weed and disease problems that solarization would perfectly cure, but they don't want to give up their garden beds for a whole season. She wants to give up her garden beds for the entire season.
It really is a perfect match, and it's a good time for us to refresh people on the correct way to solarize soil, because pretty much every single person who's ever contacted me to say that they tried it and failed did it wrong. They generally cover a bed with loose, ripped black plastic for a couple of weeks and nothing happens.
I seem to recall that you need to use clear plastic, right, with no holes, and it has to fit tightly over the bed.
Very good. Specifically, you take each plot of land you wish to purge of weeds and disease, till it all up, remove any rocks and big clumps of plant material, carefully level it, and then soak it heavily until the soil is saturated by 70%, 2 feet down. That's a lot of water. Then stretch clear plastic tightly over top, making sure the sides are well anchored. A lot of the sources I consulted suggested burying the sides of the plastic in trenches dug next to the beds to ensure a tight fit.
And the, quote, "sources" for your advice are university researchers who tested the practice over and over to find the most effective method.
Right. For once, this is not me flinging firefly frass. We read lots of published articles and interviewed many researchers when we originally compiled this information. And sorry, folks, but the length of time necessary for this project to be successful is an absolute drop-dead minimum of 6 to 8 weeks undercover. And that's in the hottest deep south and western parts of the country during the hottest months of the year. In the mid to upper south, we're talking all of June, July, and August. In more northern parts of the country, it's only going to work if you get that plastic on by around May 1st, leave it on all season, and have a fairly hot and sunny summer. But northerners can greatly increase their chance of success by using two sheets of plastic, because that'll heat up the soil more by trapping warm air between those two layers.
Well, we've specified clear plastic, but did the researchers define a thickness?
These researchers defined everything. Now, their studies found that the thinnest plastic, a mere 1 mil thick, heated the soil best. But the studies also found that this thin plastic ripped up easily. And so a common recommendation we found is to give up a little bit of potential heat, but gain a lot of strength by using 2 mil thick sheets of plastic. Do it right, and the process is guaranteed to kill almost all weeds in their seeds and to rid the soil of diseases like the wilts that prevent you from planting tomatoes in the same spot year after year. And it's even good for the soil. For some reason nobody can figure out, it actually increases the levels of nutrients and beneficial soil dwellers the following year.
You emailed our listener a link to our previous article on this topic, and she wrote back, "I love this answer. I have had some of the diseases mentioned in the article, and I love that this means I don't just have to do nothing. I can do something that helps instead. Thank you."
Well, that sure was some cool information about hotbeds now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to solarize my salad greens if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location when you send that email or we will send you spam in return. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where the only spam is in a can and nobody cares what your location is, but where you will find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our perpetually popular podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz keeps our website productive, assisted by our savage she-devil, Sarah Kazar. Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, would like to take a year off. Our editor, Al Banks, voted against going to a four-day week here at the station because he didn't want to come in the extra day. Our intern, Eileen Kelly, is always on. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I follow the advice of the late, great Yogi Berra and take a two-hour nap every day from 1 to 4 so that I can see you again next week. Spring is here, and many of you probably just noticed that you need a new lawn. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal who can accomplish that easily and which ones of you need to sit on your spreader, plus your fabulous phone calls.